Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. With all that getting, get an understanding again. Welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us this evening to join the conversation is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Program is streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com. That's timeforanawakening.com and listen to the program streaming live. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and listen to the program streaming live there. You can download the TuneIn app and any of your devices. The TuneIn app is a free app. Your desktop, your iPad, your iPhone, tablet. Download that TuneIn app, and in the search engine of TuneIn, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can listen and stream the program live, even into your car. It's Time for Awakening with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. You can also hit us up on Facebook. Time for Awakening has a Facebook fan page. In that search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll see always interesting comments and articles being posted daily. Before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. Also, Time for Awakening Media has been launched. In your search engine and your address bar, just type in timeforanawakening.com. It should already be one of your favorites. That's timeforanawakening.com in that address bar, and you'll see Time for Awakening Media pop on your screen. There you'll see more interesting articles, blogs, podcasts, of the programs that you can download, listen at later times, and even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforawakening.com. Timeforawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us, activist and organizer, founder of the African Socialist International and African People's Socialist Party, and leader of the Uhuru Movement, the chairman, Molly Yeshiteli, is scheduled to join us this evening. In conversation, we'll be talking about a lot of things. We're going to touch on the 19-point National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination is one of the major topics this evening with our special guest. And we'll look to get the conversation started after we have a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our guest, special guest this evening, I want to welcome Philadelphia neighborhood activist and tour guide at the African American History Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch. Brother Richard is with us on the line. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir. How you doing, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
Good, good, good. Look like we're getting ready to have another engaging and developing conversation with Brother Chairman O'Malley.
Yeah, you know, this is following a pattern and a path of what we're trying to do moving forward is bring folks on that are not only talking about things, but are doing them in the community, giving a people a blueprint, even though we've had people since we've been here on these shores that have given us blueprints on how we can move our people forward. We have people now that are active with active blueprints and active pathways to move our people forward. And our special guest this evening is no exception. I know that you attended the meeting this afternoon, but we'll talk about some of the things that was covered at the UNIA meeting a little later on when we get an opportunity, Brother Richard, because I know it's always interesting, especially with some of the young leadership that's there. It's necessary. We've talked about it before. It's necessary to start infusing some of the young leadership in a lot of these organizations. But we'll talk about that a little later on. I want to bring our guest on, but before we do that, I want to play a little clip of our special guest. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. I see I was having a little problem with that audio clip, but there's no problem. We'll go straight to our guest, activist, organizer, founder of the African Socialist International, ASI, and African People's Socialist Party, APSP, and the leader of the Uhuru Movement. The chairman is with us. O'Malley Yeshiteli. Chairman O'Malley, how are you, sir?
I'm very well. Thank you so much, my brother, for having me.
I'm glad that you were able to join us today on Time for Awakening, and I'm here with my co-host, Brother Richard.
How you doing, Brother O'Malley? Chairman O'Malley.
I'm very well. Thank you, Brother Richard. Thank you so much.
Chairman O'Malley, before we get started, because we want to touch on a lot of things this evening, I one of the main things I want to touch on is the 19-point plan. A political agenda for self-determination for our people here in the United States and worldwide, to be honest. But before we do that, I want to touch on the candidates forum or the electoral candidate school for Black activists. The Black is Back Coalition put it on at Petersburg this weekend. Brother Cam Howard, who was guest with us from Encobra a couple of weeks ago, informed us of what was going on. And just want to touch on, the candidates forum, how things went, the developing young political minds to approach these things from a conscious Black perspective. Talk about the candidates training session, and then I'll ask some questions in reference to that before I get to the 19-point agenda.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for introducing that question, and we have a lot of appreciation for Brother Cam. The school, we think, was really important, and part of what it is about is challenging the status quo and this group of leaders who have become this political class that's stepped up after the brutal murder, defeat of the Black Revolution of the 1960s, and they have been politicians who have apparently assumed leadership roles, but they haven't served our communities. They haven't done anything. They haven't, in fact, one could argue that today, where there are approximately 10,000-12,000 Black elected officials in this country, and four times as many Africans who have been appointed to positions from police chief to wardens to cabinet members and things like that. The actual conditions of existence of African people in this country are worse today than they were in the 1960s when people were even struggling for the right to vote. So we haven't been served at all. And what has happened is that the United States government murdered our leaders, assassinated leaders, destroyed most of our organizations, dispersed the membership, and then and destroyed effectively a social movement that was making all kinds of demands on the system, everything from Martin Luther King to asking for payment of a check and trying to initiate a Poor People's Campaign to Malcolm X, who was clearly articulating that black nationalism was about to control in the economy and the politicians in your own community, the man for black power. These were social, these were expressions of a social movement that placed incredible amount of stress on the social system itself. So they killed off the revolutionaries, and they denounced and slandered black power, the whole revolutionary movement, slandered Malcolm, killed Malcolm, and even killed Martin Luther King. And then what they offered us, instead of a social movement, with the so-called, with the passage in 1965 of the Voting Rights Bill, they offered us the Democratic Party. And so the Democratic Party has become a substitute for the political organizations that had attempted to serve the interests of our people, making real, genuine revolutionary demands. And most of our political activity has been confined within the Democratic Party machine. The 25% of the base of the Democratic Party, African people, and the political. Now we're at a time when, after which, after Malcolm had expressed that it was going to be the ballot or the bullet, and we were demanding black power. We're at a time now where that expression has been crushed, and the Democratic Party feel the burn, and we're for Hillary, and nonsense like this has become or simple simplicity. Demands for change and et cetera. And that's the movement has been crushed. And now we say, you know, we people who actually were hostile to the Black Power movement have been held up by the ruling media and much of the ruling class as representatives of Black Power because they hold these positions in office. But it's not Black Power. And so part of what we've felt, especially with the deepening crisis in this country and in the world, permanent state of warfare, growing attacks on our communities by police organizations, individual white people, gentrification going haywire, one out of every eight human beings in prison on this earth being a black person in this country, all of this stuff just escalating crises demand that we step forward, and especially when you look at what's happening in this last election, where both ruling party candidates went into the election polling nearly 60% negatively, 100 million people not voting at all. The guy who gets elected had up until recently, I don't know what he's got now since he's declared war against the people of Syria, but had something like a 37 to 40% popularity. It's a serious crisis, and we need to be able to move. And so we saw the electoral school as an opportunity to do that. And so we wanted to bring people who from throughout the country, whomever we could win, people who may be activists, black people who are tired and fed up with what's been happening in, with the politicians who've been posing as our leaders. We needed to be able to challenge that space and do what we can. And what we felt like in order to do this, we had to run for office. We had to have the ability to place initiatives and referendums and things like this on the ballot. But we had to run bold campaigns, and the campaigns we felt like we should use the 19 points that came from the National Black Agenda for Self-Determination, for political self-determination. And so we brought people in. We brought people with skills. We brought one brother out of Washington, D.C., who for 30 years has worked mostly with unions doing campaign strategizing, campaign consultant, Brother O'Neill. Earl O'Neill, we brought Cam in because we wanted people to be able to run around the issue of reparations and how do we frame that discussion? How do we work to get initiatives and measures and referendums on the ballot around questions like reparations, around questions like Black community control of the police and other things. We had Glenn Ford, who discussed the whole history of this, the relationship we have with the electoral process, because it's become deified, and many people assume that the only road to power is through the election. So we wanted to make clear that people understood that there was nothing sacred or sacrosanct about elections. And even though we're going to use the electoral process, it's not the only thing that we should be doing. We had Charles Barron, state assemblyman out of New York, who was very important to us because he offered up a concrete example of how an African could run for office and didn't have to punk out before the system, and who could raise questions like reparations, who could demand freedom for our political prisoners, who could fight for economic development in our communities and things like that. And he was brilliant in his presentation. We had this brother out of St. Louis, Zaki Baruti from the Universal African People's Organization, who offered up the concept of a proportional representation. We have a certain percentage of people in this country, in the cities, in the states, and counties throughout here. Then we should have power equal to that proportion, and to the proportion of the population. And how to introduce that into struggle around the electoral question. I had a brother out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Brother Khaled Rahim, from the New African Independence Party, who was running down in detail what it takes to run for office, how to get on the ballot, and the kinds of information we need in order to be successful. So it was an incredible 2 days. And then we had candidates that we are running here in St. Petersburg, Florida, for office. A 20-year-old African woman who is running on a campaign having to do with Black community control, economic development, just radical change, reparations, et cetera. And then there's a white guy under our leadership, 27 years old, who is a member of the African People Solidarity Committee that works directly under our leadership, who's running for mayor in St. Petersburg, Florida, under the slogan, Unity Through Reparations. And all of this was introduced to the people who were there. And there were people who were there from Huntsville, Alabama, from Chicago, from Houston, Texas, from St. Petersburg, Florida, Washington, D.C., New York, Philadelphia, and various other places. So it was a really powerful, I hope I mentioned Chicago as well, really powerful school. And I think it was important. Everybody learned something in the school, and people left there. The school, Bronx, New York, quite enthusiastic to go back and to see how we can begin to intervene and take the social movement back, take the social movement into the electoral process to challenge the status quo and not to give the rulers any space that they don't have to contend with the Black Revolution, as opposed to just some Black person running for office, but to take these critical demands that were born of social movements inside our country into the electoral process and see if they can handle that.
Chairman, you know, you talked about candidates running. You talked about Zaki Baruti and others being involved in the coalition. But we see that prior to a lot of these movements and what you're trying to do, a lot of our people have looked at the Democratic Party as being some type of messiah or panacea or however you want to frame it to lead our people to some type of salvation. But I want to read what you state here in the announcement of the training session to get you to expound on it, because I like the language that's used here, and I think our people really need to understand what's being stated. It says here, now on April 8th and 9th, the coalition will be using the Electoral Candidate School to train African working class people how to use the white electoral process as a method of fighting to advance our interests as a colonized and oppressed people through the National Black Agenda for Self-Determination. The school will teach the history of African involvement with the electoral system in the U.S., qualifications for running for office, how to raise money, how to frame a campaign message. The school will teach how to get the vote out and how to use the referendum and ballot initiative process as additional means of getting the National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination issues on the ballot. But talk about the importance of that, because I don't think that, I don't think a majority of our people, I think a segment of our people understand that the way that we have been approaching this political process is through a Eurocentric, through European eyes or from Eurocentric framework. But what you're talking about is something more cultural, a more of an Afrocentric approach to using this framework to move our people forward. Talk about what you state here and how important it is for our people to develop a new mindset if we want to use politics to help our people.
I appreciate that. But the first thing I would like to do, I really would like to remind our listeners, and we have to remind ourselves, is that the way we're approaching politics today is no accident. That it took the assassination of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and the destruction of the Black Panther Party and revolutionary leaders throughout this country who were really building a social movement. And it took crushing that and then replacing the social movement that we were building with the electoral process as a substitute and as the only means by which we can struggle for freedom. So what we are talking about and what you just mentioned, of course, is Malcolm X. He's talking. He says the politics of Black nationalism simply means that the Black people should control the politics, the politicians in our communities, and that the economic position of Black nationalism means that we should control the economy of our community. And even Martin Luther King, when he was talking about the government that they owe us a check, and we want to come for our check. So these were demands that were really being sharply expressed in our movement. Rebellions were happening throughout this country. The Black Panther Party, with its own 10-point program that was talking about what we should, what we needed, what we want, what we demand, and then the government killed it, crushed it. And then this substitute that you are talking about, how politics is now approached, so that the social movement that respond to the aspirations and the interests of our colonized people is not expressed through the electoral process, because the revolutionaries and the revolutionary organization and the social movement was destroyed. Now what we've seen happen in the recent period, after more than two generations of Black people being denied access to revolutionary leadership in general, we saw a rise in consciousness that exploded after August 9, 2014, and the people on Canfield Drive and Ferguson rose up, young Black working class people rose up with the chant, "Kill the police." And we saw a rebellion unleashed there that raised the morale of Black people throughout this country who have been tired of the Trayvon Martins, tired of seeing Black people gunned down all around this country. And it is the thing that helped to explode the consciousness. Not the death of Mike Brown, but the response to the death of Mike Brown, who they left laying in the 100-degree-plus asphalt street for 4.5 hours. This response is the thing that energized our community. And then what you saw, people who didn't want to talk to you about Black power, Black people, Africa, et cetera, that's all people wanted to talk about then, and there was a rise in consciousness. But that movement was hijacked. So you had the young people who were making a certain demand, and now all of a sudden the demand is hands up, don't shoot, Black Lives Matter, which is not a demand at all, it's a whine. And we were suffering from a situation where there were no demands being made on the government, on the state, or on ourselves. So if you say Black Lives Matter, then what is the response to that? What does that mean? What does that inform Black people that we should be doing? So that's why the coalition was extremely important, because it's more than just one organization. is several organizations and personalities representing different tendencies within our movement that stand for self-determination. Everybody don't even mean the same thing when we say self-determination. Everybody doesn't even have the same understanding of what reparations should be about. Everybody does believe in self-determination and reparations. And this is what we're now pushing back onto the political arena. When the government attacked our movement in the 1960s, everybody didn't mean the same thing about black power, but everybody understood black power and said, we're going to fight for black power. And even the same thing was true with civil rights and other things, and that's been missing in our movement today. And those people who have been pacifiers, who have been pretending to be leaders, who have been elected to office, who have been anointed and appointed by the white rulers in this country and the ruling class itself with its own representatives in power, have been articulating, they've been establishing the narrative of what everything should be about. And the Democratic Party, as you know, is not a revolutionary organization, never has been, never will be. Although some people have succeeded in making some things happen through the Democratic Party, they've gone into it and taken it over, like in what we see in East New York, in Brooklyn, you know, like with Charles Barron, et cetera, who is an extreme exception. So now we've unleashed the struggle is to unleash the people and take it away from these politicians who represent white power, who do not represent the interests of black people. And when this happens, then what you will hear is a different kind of political articulation. You won't hear the so-called Eurocentric articulation, because the pain that's experienced in our community is not a white pain. It's not a Euro pain. It's an African pain that comes from being dominated and colonized by white power going on 600 years. And that's the struggle we're involved in, and that's what we're introducing back into a social movement that it will express itself in part through the electoral process as part of the way to move toward achieving genuine black power over our own lives. And as for me, I'm jealous about the concept of power, and it's something that I don't think we will ever share with anybody else. We want all the power, but that's ultimately what it is that we're fighting for. So to unleash this community, to unleash young black people, to give some kind of leadership through this kind of platform, this is what we can struggle for. To help the community to be bold enough to fight for this platform, to not allow the Democratic Party or our nice liberal friends to define what it is permissible, what is permissible to fight for and what is not permissible to fight for. When I began doing work around reparations in mid-1970s, white liberals and so-called leftists were claiming that the reparations demand represented some kind of lunatic fringe. This is literally what they were saying. But they can't say that anymore, because more and more people throughout Africans throughout the world are talking about reparations. And even the United Nations, as you know, had to conclude that African people here deserve reparations for slavery, and that it was a crime against humanity what has happened to us, and Africans deserve reparations for colonialism.
Yes.
So this is a politic that is a reflection of the actual needs and aspirations of black people, as opposed to a narrative that has been created by white power that is sometimes articulated by black people.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation, and you can get involved too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We got a lot of callers on the line, and I'm getting a little feedback that our audio is not what it should be. I'll work on that, because I'm not only the host, but the chief bottle washer and engineer. So I'm wearing a lot of hats. Brother Richard, I know you want to jump in here, but we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation with the activist, organizer, founder of the African Socialist International and African People's Socialist Party, and the leader of the Uhuru movement, the chairman, Omali Yeshiteli. We'll be right back after a brief break.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
Nah, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
No, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you would on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm going to go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
What is in 1 million brothers and sisters who are tired of the same old rhetoric, the same old leaders, the same old ways of dealing with political and economic empowerment? If you realize that nobody's going to save black people but us, if you understand that no existing political party prioritizes the best interests of African Americans as a collective, if you believe that leadership is as leadership does, and this means that the best leaders for the black collective must come from the ranks of those who place and hold the best interests of black people foremost and uttermost, if you understand that black people must develop the mindset and the will to finance their own racial uplift organizational efforts, then get involved with 1 million conscious black voters and contributors. The movement is now. Go to www.iamoneofthemillion.com. That's www.iamoneofthemillion.com. At the end of last month, Donald Trump unveiled his military budget, obscenely inflated by $54 billion, a 10% increase that will be paid for with cuts to social programs. There was no organized denunciation from the Democrats, and a few days later, when former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear gave the Democratic Party response to Trump's speech before the Congress, he had not a word of criticism for Trump's military budget, but instead charged that the president was ignoring serious threats to our national security from Russia. Russia, Russia, Russia. It is the great diversion by which the Democrats pretend to lead a resistance to Trumpism, but present no serious opposition to Trump and his fellow Republicans' gutting of poor and working people's programs in the service of militarism. The Democrats are putting up no real fight against Trump's domestic austerity agenda. Like Barack Obama, they would welcome a grand bargain with the Republicans that freezes or shrinks the social side of the budget while continuing to fund multiple wars all over the planet. Indeed, their principal problem with Trump was that he wasn't bellicose enough. They feared that he might not be eager to play nuclear chicken with the Russians. They are implacable in their battle with Trump, the man, but put up only the most pro forma resistance to Trump's people-crushing budget proposals. Do not expect the Democrats to wage an honest fight for the people's health care interests either. The Republican plan to replace Obamacare is, as expected, an unmitigated disaster. While Obamacare was festering in its own contradictions, the Republican replacement will likely result in 10 million more uninsured Americans and total chaos at every level of health care infrastructure, resulting in an almost instantaneous social and medical crisis, and not just for poor people. The Democrats cynically see the impending disaster as an opportunity to position themselves for the 2018 and 2020 elections. Although Obamacare is dead and cannot be resurrected, they will make a show of defending its various parts, one doomed element at a time, even as the private insurance markets that are available to lower-income people disintegrate.
The Democrats will be glad to let the crisis fester under Republican corruption and incompetence, and then, as the next election season opens, propose some reworked version of Obamacare, probably with weak provisions for a public option. What they will not do, as a party, is respond to the crisis with a push for single-payer Medicare for all, a solution the party's corporate masters will not tolerate. Bernie Sanders himself has said that he has no plans to submit his own Medicare for all bill to the Senate this year, part of his accommodation with the Obama-Clinton party bosses. But that's fine. The demand should come from masses of people in the streets, representing the supermajorities that have favored single-payer for decades. This is a movement moment, and progressive activists must seize the time. The Democrats, however, anticipated that the left might take the initiative at this critical point in history, which is why they created the Great Russian Diversion, to distract silly minds. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And we had some technical difficulties. I think we're back up and running now. Loud and clear. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Okay. I think we still have Chairman O'Malley with us. Chairman O'Malley? Chairman O'Malley, are you there?
Yes, brother, I'm here.
Good, good. You know, we had a little technical difficulties here. I had to put my mind together here to get us back up and running. I'm glad we didn't lose anybody. Folks can still get back on. We're still streaming live, and I think we got some calls on hold. And people can join the conversation if they choose to at 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Brother Richard, jump in here, because before we went to break, the chairman was talking about the training session down there and the importance of restructuring our minds or approach, so to speak, to this electoral process. Jump in.
Yeah, you know, and thanks again, brother, Chairman O'Malley, for sharing with us and the listening audience, you know, just the importance of having this type of educational process around the electoral system and how our policies can be placed in, or how we can utilize it as an organizing tool in spite of its own contradictions. But one thing that you mentioned that I wanted to start off with is asking the response to Mike Brown. Would you say that that response was African people once again demonstrating the moral imperative that we place and view the world, especially in, you know, the systemic world of the West, and that the injustice of that act? And that's why those young people in this generation or in this moment broke out. And I'm asking about that moral imperative, because I think we should, if I'm correct, we should be clear that it wasn't just being angry about, and I think you make reference to it, about just the unjust killing, but what sparked us to respond to that unjust killing.
Well, if it were just a single act, out of the blue, I think that the response might have been different. But you're talking about a response that has come in the wake of a whole recent rash of police murders. Tamir Rice, you know, gunned down 2 seconds after the white man gets there. 12-year-old child in a playground with a play gun is gunned down. Ayanna Jones in Detroit, 7 years old, killed. And so, you know, when we talk about a moral imperative, we remember that our community has historically had the moral high ground in this country, and introduced this country to any concepts of freedom and democracy that it has really enjoyed. It has defined what democracy is in this country through our own struggles. And it is our condition, our struggle, our relationship to the rest of the world that has informed the morality of the oppressed African people. And our morality is different. It is the morality of the oppressed. It is a morality that demands a response to exploitation and oppression. That's how. That's why, you know, even going into the first war against Iraq, when they polled the people in this country, more than 70% of the white people were for the war. More than 70% of the Africans were against the war. And that was consistent, of course, until Obama. When Obama became president, and then you saw for the first time Africans who were pro-war based on what Obama's intentions and aggressions in the Middle East were. But historically, that's who we are. That's who we've been, which is one of the reasons Obama was so problematic, because he adorned himself with the morality of the oppressor, and because he was of our community, was able, at least temporarily, to lead African people into this immoral, this highly immoral unity with this the immorality of the oppressor. So, you know, a lot of people would treat the question of morality as a purely abstract thing, but it's not. It is our sense of morality is something that is informed by our own relationship to the world, our own oppression, the history of our own exploitation. And then, of course, we come from a different kind of society that has been, in general, historically. And it's been the immorality of the oppressor that has been stamped on the consciousness in the last period, and certainly on the consciousness of those who considered leaders in our community, who reflect more the interests of our oppressors than the interests of our community.
And that's what, and,
definitely
and,
a moral imperative. Yeah.
Yes, sir, and I appreciate you clarifying that for us, because it's important as we, you know, I really believe when we touch the party process or the state process, we have to understand how do we come to that in a as you say, not an abstract, but in a practical and another thing that you mentioned that was that your fever and understanding that it's about power.
Yes,
and that even to the moral, you know, that moral imperative is a practical power relationship that Africans bring to Western civilization or white supremacy, and that's what we have to keep hold of and keep clear of, as you mentioned.
Indeed,
one thing in that I think, as you know, you so eloquently present to us over the years, I've heard you. We have to be also clear to what imperialism is. I guess that's a question, and if not a question, could you define imperialism, especially as we talk about the new era of moving towards utilizing the democratic process of America?
I think it's really important for us to understand the issue of imperialism. We don't hear that much discussion about imperialism today, but when we do hear it, and when we have heard it mostly in the past, the definition that has informed most of us and most of the people is the one that was provided by Lenin, V.I. Lenin, who led the Russian Revolution, and ushered into Europe the socialist government in Russia. Excuse me. And Lenin defined imperialism as the highest stages of capitalism, that capitalism had become rotten right and had gone through this process. And there were different features that included parasitism and several other things. But I disagree with Lenin. You know, the word imperialism comes from the word empire. And once we understand that, then we understand that imperialism is not capitalism developed to a higher stage, but capitalism is imperialism that's developed to a higher stage. because it was imperial power of Europe that raped the world, that initiated the whole process of war against Africa that resulted in our enslavement, dispersal, and the final these false borders created in Africa. It was empire that went to what we now refer to as the Americas, took the land, decimated millions and millions and millions of the indigenous people. It was imperialism, empire, that went into China in 1841-42 and forced upon the Chinese people, who did not want to trade tea for opium, initiated what was called the Opium War, and forced the Chinese people to take that opium and turn China into a nation of junkies. This was imperialism and empire that went out and did that. And as a consequence of this, what we have is what Karl Marx called the primitive accumulation of capital. This is how capitalism got started. It's not like Jesus or Allah or somebody or some other entity came and dropped all this wealth and resources in the white world. The white world accumulated all of this as a consequence of rape and pillage, and this was the rape and pillage of empire. And from this grew this thing that we call capitalism, which is a social system that is rotten to the core, born of colonialism, born of genocide, and it has none whatsoever redeeming qualities at all. So imperialism is simply the system whereby people, a government, imposes its will on others and extract value from them upon which that system and society lives. And that's what we're saying, that Africans experienced imperialism as a part of the process that gave birth to capitalism, and it was imperialism that created capitalism and not the other way around. It's important for us to understand that. Because people would have us chasing some struggle that really is misinformed and will not take us to power. And that's what we have to do. We have to acquire power, black power of our own black lives. And I think that's going to be the starting point of changing the whole planet Earth so that everybody on Earth can know some freedom. But critical to that is going to be the liberation of Africa and African people.
And I agree, and it's interesting, as one of your one of the points of the 19 points, when we talk about that imperialism in that context that you raised, in number 5, the rollback and end of mass and black incarceration is the extension of that imperialism. We look at it as the police department, but they are the frontline soldiers. That keeps the same process of maintaining and destroying other people one way or another by killing or locking them up.
What has happened is you and I come from different kinds of societies. That is, African people and much of the world. There was this new phenomenon that developed and emerged in Europe where European society differed in many ways, and particularly from African and other societies, by the private ownership of land, private property, the land question. And what happened in that society, along with its development in Europe, where groups of people, a small group of people, began to live off of the resources of the majority of the people. At one point, they initiated slavery inside Europe, white people enslaving other white people. Rome dominating the world, putting people into slavery, and as quiet as it's kept, even though they talk about ancient deep Greek democracy, what they don't say is that something like 85% of the people in Greece, in ancient Greece, were slaves. And that was just democracy for 15% of the population. They don't say that. But so that when you have systems based on exploitation, when one group of people live at the expense of the vast majority of the other people, there has to be institutions and instruments that are created to control that group of people, because nobody's going to willingly sacrifice and go out and work all damn day and just to keep your family fat or to keep these these fat cats well off when they have nothing. Europe lived for 1,000 years under a system called feudalism, where literally people were often so poor that they were naked and afraid, if you will. And so when they reached this point where, again, where a tiny group of people living at the expense of other people, they had to have instruments of coercion, force, that could control the majority of the people. And this is what is referred to as the state. And the state is an instrument of coercion. It is there. It comes into existence when that society is split, with haves and have-nots, and the groups who have everything live at the expense of those who don't have anything. And the state is the police, it's the court system, it's the military. It's all those arms of coercion that force people to do something that they might not want to do otherwise, that keeps a society based on exploitation from blowing up, to keep the poor from going and taking everything that they need. You have a situation where you and I, we live in cities and we pass by these convenience stores, and these people who have been so demoralized and robbed of everything, they're standing out in front of these stores with styrofoam cups begging for something to eat. And the store that they're standing in front of, the shelves are overflowing with resources. But they can't just go in there and get it because it's there, because the state will intervene. And the thing that keeps hungry people from going into those shops and picking up what they need, filling up those grocery carts with food that they need to feed themselves, is this instrument called the state, the police, the jails. Those systems, that's the system, the state, that protects the status quo. And that's where you have the police. And then when that's normal to society based on exploitation. But if you have a society based on exploitation, and then you have a colonized population, where the colonized are the others, and the others get treated even worse than what might otherwise happen inside a system based on exploitation. The what happens to black people, what happens to the indigenous people, how the state treats those people. So these are other aspects of that question, and this is how the empire, however it has existed, maintains control. That's why people are bombing all over Syria and bombing and making war against people, other peoples around the world, because people want their own resources. But this empire uses its state power, Tomahawk missiles coming from the Mediterranean, killing children in Syria, or the Marines that's landing in Libya and from the shores of Tripoli, something to that effect. These are arms of state power, the atomic weapons that they're trying to use to threaten North Korea and the rest of the world. These are arms of state power to maintain the status quo, where the capitalists who coming into existence through empire and imperialism want to keep things just as they are. And this is the reason in our communities that the most impoverished, oppressed communities, you find more police per square inch than you can find any place in the country. If the police are there to protect, you would think they'd be all in the white community where everybody got everything. But they ain't in the white community where everybody's got everything. They're in the African community where nobody's got anything, because the people who got everything got it from the people who have nothing. And they want to protect that relationship, keep it just like it is, so that the oppressor never rise up and take back what belongs to us.
Thank you. Hey, Brother Elliot, I have more questions, but I'll just defer back to you as far as to keep us in line. Cause,
well, no,
we'll
mix it in because it's all dealing with the same thing. I mean, restoring our folks. We got a couple calls on hold. Before I go to them, let me say this, because I want you to speak on this before the introduction of the 19-point agenda for black political self-determination. Glancing at the Black is Back Coalition and the code of conduct, you know, myself and Brother Richard was talking last week, Chairman O'Malley, about groups that's rising up now, especially conscious groups, that we need to really adopt a code of conduct. You term it here under the Black is Back Coalition as principles of unity.
the reason I'm saying this, and I want you to expand on it from your perspective, is our people here in the diaspora has been subject to enslavement and a total brainwash by Europeans. And even the most conscious of us still have vestiges of that or scars of that brainwashing. It's necessary that when we have organizations forming, especially conscious organizations that really want to help our people, that we adopt codes of conduct and, as you term it here, principles of unity that kind of keeps our people in line, that keeps them in check. And it helps, because nobody's perfect, it helps that when you see a person going off track, that other people can help them. Talk about the importance of adopting, as you term it here, principles of unity. You have 7 principles, but talk about the importance of adopting principles of unity.
I think that's really important because there has to be some means by which we measure our behavior in relationship to each other, in relationship to our people. As you know, the coalition is an organization of organizations and institutions. But, like, if you look at the Burning Spear, which is our newspaper from the African People's Socialist Party, you will find that there are principles of there are rules of discipline. Rules of discipline. There are 19 of them to which we are committed. And any violation of these rules of discipline is subject to some kind of disciplinary action inside our party. And in addition to these rules of discipline, and we put them in the newspaper so that, as you mentioned, all of us are subject to make errors. Mm-hmm. Me, everybody else. We put them in the newspaper. So if ordinary people see our people and our party in the Uhuru movement doing anything that violates these rules of discipline, they have the ability to check them and to get in touch with the organization, say, hey, how can you say these are rules of discipline in terms of respecting and not treating women a certain way, not treating members in a certain way, and not treating the people in a certain way? And here I see Joe Blow out here, you know, carrying on in such and such a fashion. And we put it in the newspaper because we think the people should have some role in disciplining us as well. Because we can't just confer discipline on ourselves. You know, it's like the police. They say, well, we're going to investigate ourselves to see if we did something wrong. No, the people have to play a critical role in this. And that's why we put 14 points in our organization, the 14-point platform. Put it so the people can see it. So that if we violate what we're supposed to be standing for, the people can make a judgment on us and criticize us for our behavior and say that you're nothing but hypocrites, that you're opportunists. You're not doing what you say you believe in. Okay. And all of us need that kind of relationship. And the thing is, when you talk about a coalition, these are people who are not in the same organization precisely because there are things that they don't agree on enough to be in the same organization, but there are things that they agree on enough that will allow them to cooperate on a common mission if it's defined the way we have succeeded in defining the mission of the coalition. But then we say that here are the principles of unity. And they include stuff like any contradiction that comes down in this thing. We're going to resolve it by a vote. We're going to take a vote. We're going to respect, we say, the ideological differences inside this organization. This is an organization where we know the ideological differences, because if there weren't, we wouldn't be a coalition. We'd be a party. We're a coalition precisely because we know that there are differences, but there must be a way to say that we can work together despite the fact that we're not in the same organization, that we do have ideological and sometimes political differences, but there is something that around which we can unite, self-determination. We unite around that question. And there are issues. We unite in opposition to imperialism. We agree that we are opposed to annexation of people's lands and imperialist warfare, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what informs us. And then we have our annual meetings, our annual conferences in particular, where we get an opportunity to come together and say, this is what we're going to work on the coming year. We make an agreement on that. And then we go out and do the work. And so these principles of unity, we have, they are critical. And they are like the law and order for the relationship that we have, that holds us all to certain kinds of principles, and it informs anybody in the group, in the coalition, of any violation. So it's not just a disagreement with the African People's Socialist Party and some other organization that make a part of the coalition. It's a disagreement with whoever has violated this principle of unity and the whole group of us. So it's a very important thing to have, and I'm really proud because the coalition has existed now going on 8 years. And when we started off, we didn't know each other as groups. We didn't know each other sometimes as individuals. And it's shaky when you come into this kind of relationship because white power works all the time.
Yes.
Attacking our unity, our ability, our confidence, that in terms of being able to support each other and believe each other. And so it's really shaky. I mean, you don't know each other. And you got to now begin to try to interpret what did they mean in that last meeting? What does so-and-so mean by that? But we've worked and held it together for almost 8 years. Almost everybody knows what we disagree on. And everybody knows what we do agree on. And so we don't pick fights around these questions because the objective is not to come in and pick fights and to be more correct than somebody else is. It's to find that place where we all unite. And then find out how we can pursue policies and projects that enhance that unity as opposed to attack that unity. And one of the things was we said, hey, one of the problems that we're suffering from as a community is unlike in the 50s where the black community in general said we're fighting for civil rights. And even though people disagreed about maybe what that meant, everybody knew we was fighting for civil rights. Unlike in the 1960s when we said we're fighting for black power. And everybody, though we may not have had the same understanding of what that meant, we knew we were fighting for black power. and other periods where we had that comment, that has been missing for two generations now. So we say that the community doesn't even have the ability to make a demand. I mean, it's a silly, insipid kind of demand, hands up, don't shoot, or Black Lives Matter. That's not a demand. That's not a demand. And, you know, going back more than 100 years, Frederick Douglass saying power concedes nothing without a demand, never has, never will. And so we said, let's pull this. We pull the coalition together. The coalition then said we have to solve this problem of uniting our community again, but uniting it around demands, not just Black Lives Matter, but self-determination has to be the fundamental thing. That's what they killed Malcolm about. Because Malcolm was talking about we had to be a self-determining people in control of our communities, in control of our economy, in control of our politics. And so we've pushed for, and the coalition has been struggling around this for some period of time now, and I think we've done that with some success. And then these 19 points, I think, really enhance it, because now self-determination is not just a concept. We're saying in this case, in this instance, in this period, this is what self-determination looks like. When it comes to uniting our movement and uniting our people in a common direction. And these are the 19 points that we say. We do a declaration that said this is why we have to move. This is why we have to raise up this national black agenda for self-determination. And then these are the planks in that agenda for self-determination. That's what informed that process.
We're in conversation this evening with activist and organizer and leader of the Uhuru Movement, Chairman Omali Eshetele, is with us in conversation this evening, and you can join that conversation too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Chairman, the National Black Agenda for Self-Determination, the 19 points, I want to touch on some of the 19 points. I know Richard probably want to touch on some others. But that first point, I think, is paramount and important. Black women,
yes,
being restored among our people as full and equal partnerships in our struggle. I think that's an important building block. If that's not the number one building block, then the house will fall. Because
that's right.
We come from a culture where our women were reverenced as equal partners and sometimes even greater than the men.
More than equal.
Talk about the importance of that being number one.
More than equal. I mean, it has to be number one. If we were conscious, most of us, of what has happened to African women and what has happened to our relationships and our community as a consequence of the attack on our people through harming our women. How the womb of African women became a unit of production for producing property, commodities, having babies that white people could sell and make money from. If we understood what happened in even the process of getting us here from Africa, how we were hunted down like animals and walked sometimes for weeks after going into the interior, white people going to the interior, making war and capturing us, and then bringing us to the slave castles, dungeons on the coast of Africa, and how by the time African women got there, we got there, many sisters had been impregnated. If we knew what how once we were in these dungeons and how the governors of the dungeons or the slave castles would pick out women as we were brought in and have the ones they wanted to rape sent up to them. If we had an understanding of how by the time a slave ship got to the Americas after leaving Africa, so many African women had been raped and impregnated on the way, and how that was common. To be property meant that white people used us any fashion that they wanted to use us, and African women were serious and brutal targets of white oppression. How we lived in a situation where a white man could come to our house and take the woman that gave us children, who was our woman, and sleep with her, and our children knew that the white man slept with the woman, mm-hmm. and the woman could be sold off, the child could be sold off, and the impact this had just on women and then on our relationship as a whole as a consequence of this. And then everything that's happened subsequent to that. And the fact is that African women have been critical. African women haven't been these little whining sob sisters like white women. They have to create these super heroes and white women. But African women have fought, and they've fought in Africa. We've led armies fighting against the Portuguese. There's a tradition in our community of African women leaders, not just somebody to have babies, but who actually led struggles in our communities and led our whole communities. This is the tradition we've come from, and we've been reduced to this state. And I'm not talking now about some macho thing and the man supposed to protect the woman kind of thing. I'm talking about the degradation of the African nation that has come as a consequence of the assault that has been made on African women, right in full view of African men, African children. This has been a horrible thing, and it continues up today. And the thing that exacerbates the contradiction today is that most of us have adopted the worldview of white power that makes an assumption that the woman's supposed to follow the man, man's supposed to be able to make all the money and take care of everything, and then we can't do it. And so if we believe what the white man said, that the man is not a man unless he can take care of his family, and then the white man won't let you take care of your family, and if you believe that you should take care of your family to be a man, if your wife thinks you should be able to take care of your family to be a man, and that can't happen, then what does that mean in terms of our relationship as men and women? And African women have been treated as sexual objects, lustful, and there used to be, by law in this country, that African woman could not be raped. She couldn't be raped. So any white man or black person, anybody could do anything they wanted to an African woman, and legally it was all right because she couldn't be raped. That was by law. And this is the kind of stuff that, you know, has happened with us. And African women continue to be targeted in a very serious way up to today. And they're targeted because they give what they call welfare. And to get welfare, et cetera, it means that a man can't be in the house. So African woman can't have access to the man she's supposed to be with. The children can't have access to the man she's supposed to be with. So we have housing projects that are filled with black women and children because the man is being pushed out of that by policy from the United States colonial government. So the African woman is somebody that we really have to stand up and fight for, and we have to fight against that attitude in our community that has come subsequent to the influence of white power, that women ain't supposed to lead. Women have led, can lead, must lead. We have to, they have to be able to function as full partners in this revolutionary struggle that we're involved in. And I just think it's a critical question. It's a very critical question. And I'm very happy to see that we made that the first point in the 19-point platform.
Let me grab a caller here. Caller, what's your name? Where you calling from? Caller, are you there? And put them back on hold. Let's go to 602 area code. Caller, what's your name?
Yes, brother. This is Brother Marcus from Memphis.
How are you, Marcus?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. I heard it. I'm listening to the program, and I got one little thing, though, because, you know, I don't agree with the ideology of Black Lives Matter. I know they are lesbian, gay, transgender, queer, whatever. But what I do respect about Black Lives Matter is that they were on the front line. When the fire started, they went to the front line. Although they get money from George Soros, they were on the front line, you know, and I do respect that. You know, as I said, I don't really agree with their ideology of homosexuality, but I do respect that. And I would like to ask the guests, what is the real difference between communism and capitalism, and how it relates to Black nationalism? If you can expound on that for me, I would really appreciate that. And I'll hang up.
Splendid.
Thank you, Marcus.
First of all, let me say about the Black Lives Matter. Who was on the front line in Canfield Drive in Ferguson was not Black Lives Matter. It was black young black people, who working class people, who fought the police. And they were not saying hands up, don't shoot, and Black Lives Matter. In fact, the thing that took me from St. Petersburg, Florida to Ferguson was the slogan that was coming out of Ferguson for the first time from that community was kill the police. I haven't heard that since the 1960s, except it was said like off the pigs, right, who were in our community. So I think it's really important to say that. Second, it was a movement that was hijacked. And by that, I mean that the people who initiated that struggle in Ferguson, those are not the people you see on TV articulating. Those are not the people who created a hashtag. Black Lives Matter is a hashtag. And what happens is that people all around the country, as a consequence of that hashtag, almost everything that they were doing, it was being referred to as Black Lives Matter. And because they were fighting against the police themselves or other kinds of policies, they call themselves Black Lives Matter. So I just think it's really important to make that distinction. Second, the whole question of homosexuality, I don't give a damn if somebody's homosexual, heterosexual, asexual, and what have you. If they're fighting against colonial oppression, that's the thing that I want to unite with. I don't. My struggle with the Black Lives Matter is not because there's supposed to be some homosexuality, which I don't think is an ideology, but I think the ideological expression of Black Lives Matter is the slogan itself, Black Lives Matter, because it does not inform anybody what to do. It doesn't make any kind of demand what to do, how to struggle. And that's not the expression of the working class. That's not the expression of people who are fighting against the police on a daily basis. That stuff came from students and what have you, who came to Ferguson and came to the Canfield Drive from some college campuses. But the people who lived there, who were Mike Brown's friends and neighbors and cousins and people who have to face the police every day in these housing projects, they didn't come up with the slogan Black Lives Matter. So it became popularized and it became a hashtag. I just wanted to make that distinction. Secondly, the question of capitalism. Capitalism was born, first of all, through slavery. It was the what Karl Marx referred to as the primitive accumulation, the initial money, the initial resources that went into establishing the capitalist system itself came through selling black people. And I think it's really important to understand it. And as a system, what capitalism means, first of all, that it's parasitic. It's a parasitic social system. That's what you call something that comes from slavery, comes from genocide of the indigenous people, stealing their land, stealing labor. That's a parasite. And so it is inherently a parasitic social system. It has no redeeming qualities about it whatsoever. It is based on private ownership of property and resources that comes of resources that are produced by socialized production. So you have socialized production, people who come together collectively to produce every damn thing that's produced, but it's owned privately by somebody who don't work or don't do anything at all. That's capitalism. Capitalism is based on what's referred to as a wage labor, where people work and then only get paid for their ability to get food, get a beer, pay the rent and stuff like that, and come back and work tomorrow. But they don't get paid the full value of their labor. They get paid the value of their ability to labor, which is enough for food, clothing, and shelter, and to come back and work the next day. And they don't have the ability for socialized ownership of the means of production or anything like that. Socialism, if you will, is that time when the working people who produce all the value, because only workers produce value, bankers don't produce value, stock markets do not produce a damn thing. Everything that is produced that has value has come about as a consequence of working people putting our hands to nature and transforming it in a fashion that is now worth something. And under capitalism, it's called commodity production, because everything that is produced under capitalism is for sale. And so if you talk about health care doesn't happen because somebody is sick. People have hospitals and things like that to make money. And grocery stores don't exist because to feed hungry people. Grocery stores exist to make money. So if you are sick and don't have any money, you can look a hospital filled with empty beds and you cannot occupy those beds because you're sick. You have to have money. You have to have money to eat. So that's capitalism. It's a ruthless a system that has to exploit somebody in order to exist, and the people who do the exploiting don't do any producing at all, and the people who do the producing don't have the ability to own anything socially that we produce. People make cars and can't afford to buy a car. People build houses, can't afford to live in a house, because that's how capitalism functions, because somebody who don't build houses but make money off houses being built, they're the ones who own and control that capacity. Socialism is when the workers have overturned the state system that protects this relationship, that allow a handful of people, that allows a handful of people to steal the value that has been created by people in society that creates everything that's there. And when the workers take power, that is, and institute our own state, a worker state, that is only there for the purpose of oppressing, jailing those oppressors to make sure that they cannot rise up again to take to recreate the system that gives us the ability to reorganize the society, reorganize production, so that now you have not only socialized production, but you have socialized ownership. That's what socialism is. That's the worker state, and it is suggested that over a period of time, once you remove the profit motive from production and society, once you eliminate this kind of unjust system, sooner or later, the need for a state that oppresses, exploits anybody disappears, and that's the time when you have communism, no oppression, no exploitation of anybody in the society.
We're in conversation with activist and organizer and founder of the African People's Socialist Party and leader of the Uhuru Movement, Chairman Omali Eshetele, is with us, and you can join the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Let's go to 314 area code. 314, turn your radio down. Turn your radio down, 314. 314. 314 area code. Let's put them back on hold. They must have stepped away from the phone. Chairman Omali, the third point on the Black Agenda for Self-Determination is community control of police. We know that other communities, other nationalities, basically control the police in their communities. The black communities, police are in control of the communities. Other communities dictate how the police interact with their communities. We don't control how the police interacts with our communities, even to the point where our innocent people are murdered. Talk about the need for that being a part of the self-determination agenda. And I want to mix it in with this. You have a lot of black politicians now, and you've termed them a lot of different things in some of the literature here, traitors and things of that nature, which I totally agree. You have black politicians that can do things to help our community start mechanisms to control police and police our own communities. An example is, for example, in white communities, you have certain amount of tax dollars being funneled towards community organizations to set up town watches, to get reflective jackets, walkie-talkies, hats, monogram coats so that people know their town watch. They don't necessarily go in their pockets to do this. A lot of times it's tax dollars funneled to these community organizations to set up town watches and things like that where they can police their communities and so-called help the authorities police their communities. But we don't have that in our communities. And these black elected officials don't come up with any dollars to help us do any types of community policing. The only solution they have is if you see something going on, call the police. They don't come up with innovative ideas to help us funnel dollars to get us mechanisms to police our own communities. Talk about that third point when you talk about community control of police.
Well, the issue of the community control of police is something that responds to the fact that the police play a particular role in our communities, not to get cats out of trees, kittens out of trees, or help a little ladies across the street. It's a terrorist organization, a military occupation, a force that's been imposed on our community from the outside, which is why the founding of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California, when they were founded, they were called the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. It was an organization, and this is where you see a meaningful attempt in our community for community control of the police. And this this instance, of course, you saw black people who were armed and would come to the scene where police were and threatening and to harm our people let the police know that there could be an armed response to their aggression. We saw a situation in the late 1960s with the rise of the Black Liberation Army in New York. I should never forget this. When the police were killing our people in New York and the Black Liberation Army, BLA, indicated that henceforth, anytime a cop shoots a black person, we're going to shoot a cop. And that happened. And that's when you saw a real reduction in police killings in our community when there was a consequence that had to be paid for. That was a form of black community control of the police. We have not achieved, we saw, you know, in Dallas, Texas, and again in Baton Rouge, I think it was Louisiana, mm-hmm. where Michael Johnson. X Johnson, mm-hmm. and Cosmo, I've forgotten his last name right now, they came out armed and killed the killers who are in our community. That's a response, a legitimate response to control these terrorists who are in our communities. And the thing that, again, I want to remind us is that the police are an arm of the state. They are not in our communities to help us. They are a military occupying force to control the community. And it's not that I'm saying that there are no problems in our community that we don't need to take on and that we don't need to create organization in our community to resolve those, because there are. But the majority of the problems in our community come from the fact that our communities are economically quarantined, that there is no public policy of economic development for our community, so they put forth a public policy of police containment. So let's starve the niggas, there's no jobs and new resources, pump in drugs and this kind of stuff, and then put the police there to control them. That's how the police function. It's a military organization. It's the first line of defense that the system puts up against the people to control the people who are colonized and who are subject to rise up and fight back any moment, and they don't know when, like we saw happen in Ferguson, like we saw happen in Milwaukee, and like we've seen happen in so many other places over periods of time in this country. So when we say black communities control the police, it's not asking anybody to come out and act like Micah X Johnson was it?
Mm-hmm.
We're not saying do that. We're not even telling people to do like the Panthers and patrol the cops with guns. But we are saying that the community has to make this demand, and then we have to, when you talk about money to use for reflective jackets and stuff like that, look at the money that the state spends in every city in this country where black people are there. The inordinate amount of money that goes to policing black people, we want that money ourselves. And then we will redefine what policing is. It's not your police department, it's our police department. That's what it has to be. You can't have this force that functions as an outside agency that intrudes in our community looking for trouble that they call crime. So anytime the police comes to our community, it's looking for a problem. It doesn't come to help the people. It's looking for what they call crime. It's what you see. You see cops chasing young black people all the time, day in and day out. And they find crime when there is none. I thought it was a gun. I was afraid for my life. I killed this person, killed that person. So we're saying that we hire, we fire, we establish the policies of what the police are there for, and that the police, if you're going to be in this community, police in this community, you're going to live in this community. Somebody needs to wake you up 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning if we need you. And you have to be in a community where you suffer the same kinds of problems and issues that the community suffers. So that what you're doing is solving our problem and not the problem of the government that wants to control us. What are our problems? We need jobs. We need decent housing. We need health care. We need roads fixed and stuff like that. The police need to become an arm of the community that serves the people and function in that fashion. And they could do that under the leadership of the people who would have hiring, firing, training policies, saying what the police and even whether the police should be armed. I mean, these are the decisions that our community needs to make as opposed to somebody who never sets foot in our community until they come to do some harm to our community. This is a step towards self-determination. When we begin to address the question of state power and the police as an arm of state power, to assume the responsibility of state power in our own hands, this is a genuine step towards self-determination. And it's a democratic demand. What is the argument that white people, white power can have against black people in our own community, since you say this problem is intractable? Tractable. If you say that this is a problem that's cultural because white people, the police don't know how to get along with the community, then what in the hell is more democratic than giving the power of the people of the police to the people who are being policed by this up to now outside military force? It's a genuine democratic demand, and it's one that takes us a step closer to self-determination.
I have to say, Chairman O'Malley, when you say that, I'm looking at 13, the right to free education. And in my mind, well, there's two sides of it to me. When we come from the perspective of power, based off of, as you laid out, the history of African people being under this here imperialist thrust of European domination and Western culture. One of the things that gives me, or I'm saying, the solid response that the community, the people of the community, and primarily women, going to point one, was when they were moving politically, even if they didn't know, towards the charter school system. It seems that to me that was African people moving, knowing that education was important, and knowing that the public educational system was not delivering, and looked for an alternative, and it took the state through a tweet, made them out of their mind, because so many people, so many women decided to utilize that offer of not being a part of the public educational system. So, and to me, that ties to that right, where African people mobilized, in the community, mobilized to actually decide that the public education wasn't delivering, and we were going to go towards where we see the possibility of where what it could be able to be done. But from the act of power, where we're going to take control over the education of ourselves by making that act. So I'm glad to see that y'all have placed that right to free education as the primary objective or plank of these 19 points, and which could you develop that as far as either how that came into being, or do you see that that was a political move that people were making, or women were making at that time, at this time?
Think that you're right that Africans and African women were looking for a response to what's happening in the public education system. But I think that it is a response. What it is that I remember in San Francisco when we were headquartered in San Francisco, and I was to make a speech, and a sniper fired a rifle through the window. And fortunately, somebody had initially closed the door that opened into that auditorium where they would have been able to fire directly at me, and they fired into a light, and they fired in the window. And the thing is that when they did that, they created a situation where I had to try and move to secure myself, and the movement had to secure ourselves from that sniper act and from further aggressions that we saw coming at us. But what it was, we came to understand, is the state, the government had fired that rifle, somebody attached with the government, and then they created a situation where my response to being shot at would take me into the arms of somebody who was supposed to be helping us that was also working with the state. And so it was to push me in a particular direction. It wasn't to help me. It was to make sure that that's where I ended up. And I think we have to be careful, because public education system in this country was created during Reconstruction by African people coming out of slavery. We're the only ones who had an interest in a public education and rapidly educating ourselves. And what's happening over a period of time, and especially since the so-called desegregation in the South, where white people were forced to come into these schools where Africans were and vice versa, you've seen the emergence of what they call school resource officers, cops on the campuses, fences being put up to separate the campus from the people, and all kinds of horrid things happening on the campus to our children, just a real major assault on the educational possibilities, and then an assault on public education altogether. So that education increasingly there's an effort being made to privatize or make public education no longer public, so that it's not as accessible to masses of people as it's supposed to be. And we have dabbled momentarily with the whole charter school thing too, because public education system is horrible. But I really believe that what we're going to have to do, two things. One, I think we're going to have to create our own institutions in our communities, our institutions, not the charter schools and anything like that. But the vast majority of our people are not going to come to our schools. That's because we don't have the resources. We don't have the money. And the so-called private, freedom schools and things I've seen like that since the 1960s, only middle-class black children can afford to go to them. So we're going to have to make that fight to take the schools back. We're going to have to take the public schools back, and we're going to have to make them function in the interests of our children like they're supposed to do, even as we do education of our own in our communities, because those are public tax dollars. And I'm not some slave to the idea of being involved in the public school system just for nothing. But what they're attempting to do is create a situation where only the most elite sectors of the population can have any kind of education. And I do know what you're talking about. We're talking about the failure of the public education system. I live in a county in Florida that has the lowest graduation rate for black boys in the country, where only 26% of black boys who are in the public education system will graduate. So I know what it is that we're looking at in terms of the crimes committed against us. The other things that we have done in the past, we don't have it effectively now. We've created black community. We've created free child care collectors in our community where groups of our people have got together. We've created a free school process where the homeschooling collectives do that kind of stuff. But I do believe that we're going to have to find a way, even as we do these things, to fight to take the public education system and make it serve us until we have more power so that we can create effectively our own kind of system. And I went through that whole thing. I know it was a long drawn kind of response because I respect the question.
It's correct, and I agree. I agree, or I also see that contradiction as you characterize in relationship to the movement towards this private educational process called privatization of education, and so I definitely understand and the challenge, and that's why I thought it's good that y'all have it as a platform. When you're talking about developing candidates, because that becomes a political, it is political to take
yes.
over the public educational system.
Yes.
And if you can move that mobilization to having those women, having the community organize around education, then as you said before, and when you go pre-1960, when black education was quote unquote segregated, and you had those again black women teachers teaching
yeah.
and being effective,
yes.
you know, then we'll be moving back to the center that we know or that power that is necessary. So I agree wholeheartedly what you're saying.
I think we have to fight for black community control of the schools. You know, mm-hmm. I think we have to fight. Especially if we live in communities. You know, like some places they've succeeded and dispersing the population of black people, destroying black neighborhoods, because that's something that's happening everywhere, too,
yes.
gentrification, other kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a black community, I think we have to really fight for black community control of the schools. And you know, we saw community control of schools happen in Brownsville, in New York, in the 1960s and whatever. Monumental struggle, you know, where the whole African community was up in arms. And I think that we're going to have to make that struggle to control the educational process. We have situations, I don't know how it is, where you are located, but particularly throughout the South, they've pushed black teachers out. We've got instances where African students are able to go to school, and then they don't see any black teachers. All the teachers are white, and which is not to say that at this time and place that these black teachers are any kind of revolutionary or progressive entities, but black children need access to black teachers. Black children need to be able to project the future of themselves through looking at these teachers, black teachers. That's a statement of some kind of success. That you can be as a child. But if all your teachers are white and are not sympathetic with the aspirations of our community, then that's going to be reflected in the outcomes of the school system itself.
Hey,
and I'm fortunate. Yeah, yeah.
Let's go to 404 yeah. Erico. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, my name is Wes, man. Good conversation, my brother. Hey, my brother, first of all, That county in Florida, is that Broward County you're talking about?
No, that's not Broward. It's Pinellas County.
Okay, because I was raised down there in Fort Lauderdale, see? And,
yeah.
And what you're saying is correct. But, see, my point is I had this discussion with Richard and Elliot, okay? the point is, I think it's the hardest thing to do for me, what I had to do, I went back and researched every damn lie that I was told, and we celebrated culturally, and I went and researched and scrapped everything, okay, because everything was a lie. So my point is, before the children get to school, the first teacher should be their mama. And see, if we can get, how can we get these sisters and our people to just scrap every damn these holidays, okay, just start scrapping. Everything is a lie. Just throw all that out. To a total of brainwashing and rebrainwashing to get them to really start researching. I was just on Facebook, which I shouldn't have been, and this fool come tell me talking about some April Fool, man. My head exploded. Because I said, look here, bro, the fool is, y'all coming in here talking about January 1st is New Year. Okay, I said Happy New Year, bro. Okay, and look here. Another thing is, man, I think everybody, y'all familiar with this documentary called Goodbye, Uncle Tom?
Yes.
Oh, man, I heard a lot of people talking about that, man. So finally, I started looking at it, man. I couldn't look at that but halfway through, Elliot, man. I mean, if people think Roots got folks, you were talking about how we was prisoners of war behind enemy lines of slavery. And I remember when Roots came out, everybody was fired up. I think it should be required, man, everybody to see Goodbye, Uncle Tom, man, okay? Instead of this foolishness empire, everybody should see Goodbye, Uncle Tom, man, because that means, oh, man, that got me speechless and mad, and I really want to try to get my people to wake up, man, and I don't want to take up too much time, man, but cause, like this week coming up now, these fools going to be talking about some damn Good Friday, man, and that's a lie. You see what I'm saying? My brother, you see what I'm saying? Y'all see what I'm coming at, right?
I do. Yeah. I mean, I do. And that's part of what, when you're taking captives. And there is this thing that's called, in my estimation, a European nation. And coming into existence through the process of slavery and colonialism, this entity that we now know as Europe comes into being. The entity that we now know as the European is born through this process. And consolidating their national identity is associated with all kinds of holidays and things like that. Once you have state power, you do that. You have a national anthem. You can say these are national holidays. You can do all of this thing. And this part of this is to create a sense of sameness among the people who are a part of that nation. But if you have colonial subjects, the colonial subjects end up experiencing a sense of sameness with their oppressor, celebrating the same holidays that the oppressor has created for the purpose of uniting itself in relationship that it has with us and everybody else in the world. And that's why the whole question of national liberation, self-determination is such a critical question, that we are not going to be able to integrate into this system as some kind of solution. We're going to have to fight for, we have to develop a capacity for self-government and self-governing ourselves, and then we're going to have to fight for liberation from this thing to achieve the power. And in the process of this struggle, we began to institutionalize our own holidays. That's meaningful to us, not in some kind of, sham way, not some Black Christmas, because that's not the thing that's missing for us as a people without power, but to begin to develop our own holidays. You know, I can see a holiday around the birth, life of Malcolm and Garvey and Huey P. Newton and other people who played incredible roles and other dates that are significant to our resistance and things like that. This is what we have to do. And we don't even have to wait on somebody to do that for us. We can begin to do these things ourselves. Mm-hmm. We don't have to, your enemy kills Martin Luther King and then gives you a holiday. We can create our own holidays and celebrate them ourselves. And when I say we, what I mean by that, particularly as we grow organizationally and connect with each other, we can begin to do these things. Just like you find a dance that comes out in the Bronx and New York, and people are doing it in Dallas, Texas, and all of this, we can begin to, we share culturally with each other. And we just have to be able to see the significance in separating ourselves ideologically and politically from a hostile colonial state power that only exists for the purpose of oppressing us and exploiting us and could not exist were it not for this oppressive and exploitive relationship that it has with us. So, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, it's horrible. And the reason they can do that is because they kill off the people and destroy the organizations that would be taking us in some other direction.
Yes, sir. And see, what my point is, where we messed up in the 60s, where we depended on one leader, they bumped that leader off, then the whole movement stalled. My point of contention is...
No, we weren't depending on one leader.
Right, brother. Right. Let me throw this out.
I mean, they kill every damn body. They killed King. Right. They killed Malcolm. They killed 30 members of the Black Panther Party in 1968 alone. They were killing all over the country. And it was not just one leader. I think it's really important to understand that. Yeah. The thing is that leaders spring from our communities because they win our support. And it's not just like, okay, let's have a lot of leaders. I don't think it's that simple. I think that leaders are those who have the courage, who step forward. That's what a leader. That's why you call them leaders, because they step forward. They step beyond where most of us are, and most of us are willing to go. And this is and if you got people who are too timid, are too afraid, are too cowardly to step forward, then they don't deserve to be leaders. But we have produced quite a bit of leaders. But we're up against a very vicious system that was not just killing us. Take the Black Revolution of the 60s that we considered defeated. In the 1960s alone, they killed King, they killed Malcolm, they killed several members of the Black Panther Party, they killed Patrice Lumumba, they overthrew Kwame Nkrumah, they captured a wounded Che Guevara and murdered him. They were killing people all around the world to keep their... So it wasn't that we had one leader and they just killed him and the thing collapsed. They initiated a whole counter...
My point I'm trying to is going forward...
I'm sorry.
Each one of us going to end up being leaders, because when these crackers get through putting their foot up out behind and kick us out in the front, each and every one of us, like me, you, Brother Elliot, Richard, everybody that we talk to, it's going to be everybody like playing football, you know, next man, next woman step up. That's the point I'm trying to make right now.
Yes.
Okay? We're going to knock this damn system down, all of us.
We're going to beat them.
Okay?
This is our time. This is our time.
You know,
it's
I'm
in a
say
state of
more...
severe crisis. This is our time.
I'm going to say this and I'm going to hang on. Let somebody talk, but it's a damn fool to keep subsidizing our oppression. I'm fighting the uphill battle trying to get my people to stop funding your own oppression, man. And it's aggravating me, man. That's why every time I'm talking to my people about every holiday, I go to research and explain them the origin of the holiday. And 99% of it is we celebrating our own oppression, and I'm fighting an uphill battle, man. That's my mission right there. So I slap some fists in these brothers and sisters' head, man, with knowledge.
Thank you for your call, Wes. Peace.
Yeah.
Brother Owen Wally, I know I kept you over an extended time. You got a few more minutes to spend with us?
Well, let's do a few.
Okay, good. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll spend a few more minutes with our special guest, activist, organizer, founder of the African People's Socialist Party, and leader of the Uhuru Movement, Chairman Omali Yeshiteli. We'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. Sundays, 7 p.m., with your host, Elliot.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here. As many of you know, last March, when it was announced that I was no longer in the Black Muslim movement, it was pointed out that it was my intention to work among the 22 million non-Muslim Afro-Americans and to try and form some type of organization or create a situation where the young people, our young people, the students and others, could study the problems of our people for a period of time and then come up with a new analysis and give us some new ideas and some new suggestions as to how to approach a problem that too many other people had been playing around with for too long. And that we would have some kind of meeting and determine at a later date whether to form a Black Nationalist Party or a Black Nationalist Army. There have been many of our people across the country from all walks of life who have taken it upon themselves to try and pool their ideas and to come up with some kind of solution to the problem that confronts all of our people. And tonight we are here to try and get an understanding of what it is they've come up with.
The economic philosophy of Black nationalism only means that we should own and operate and control the economy of our community. You would never find, you can't open up a Black store in a white community. White man won't even patronize you. And he's not wrong. He got sense enough to look out for himself. And you who don't have sense enough to look out for yourself. The white man is too intelligent to let someone else come and gain control of the economy of his community. But you will let anybody come in and control the economy of your community. Control the housing, control the education, control the jobs, control the businesses, under the pretext that you want to integrate. No, you're out of your mind. The economic philosophy of Black nationalism only means that we have to become involved in a program of re-education to educate our people into the importance of knowing that when you spend your dollar out of the community in which you live, the community in which you spend your money becomes richer and richer. The community out of which you take your money becomes poorer and poorer. And because these Negroes who have been misled, misguided, are breaking their necks to take their money and spend it with the man is becoming richer and richer, and you're becoming poorer and poorer. And then what happens? The community in which you live becomes a slum. It becomes a ghetto. The conditions become run down. And then you have the audacity to complain about poor housing in a run-down community. Why, you run it down yourself when you take your dollar.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and we're joined in conversation this evening by a special guest, activist, organizer, founder of the African People's Socialist Party, and leader of the Uhuru Movement, Chairman Omali Yeshitela, is with us in conversation this evening. You can get involved, too, in the time that we have left with him by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. I want to play a clip that I tried to play earlier when we had a little technical difficulties, but I want to play it now for our listening audience.
Let's get a reaction.
As far as Michael Brown.
Hold on, Frederick Peterson. Let's get a reaction then from Omali Yeshitela on this. Go ahead, Omali.
He wants to characterize what I have to say about the situation as fanciful. Is the fact that in this country, Africans over the last 2 years who have encountered police have been 21 times more likely to die than white people with those encounters. Is that fanciful? Is it fanciful that we live in a country where, with this huge prison population, where one out of every 8 human beings in prison in the world today is an African in this country? This country is notorious for having murdered the indigenous population here, stolen half of Mexico, and enslaved African people, and we've been struggling since that time to win our freedom. And if we have a pause in that struggle, it has simply been because the United States has succeeded 2 generations ago in crushing, murdering people like Martin Luther King, murdering people like Malcolm X, destroying the Black Panther Party, which is something that the Attorney General of the United States said in 1969 when he came to power that by the end of the year he would have destroyed the Black Panther Party. So don't talk to us about fanciful. What is fanciful is this notion that you've been able to promote around the world of America being this beacon for democracy. What is fanciful is somehow that America can travel all over the world and murder people and call it being something that's going to assist and help the people. What is fanciful is the fact that, yes, you can drag out every now and then what you would call a decent, good Negro to parrot the line of white power. But the reality of our conditions of existence is something that anybody can see. It's not fanciful. The data speaks for itself.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. That was the voice of our guest, Chairman of the Uhuru Movement, Omali Yeshitela. Mr. Chairman. Brother Omali, you stay there? Brother Omali, you still with us?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, I had... Yeah,
oh, no, no,
yeah,
no. No problem.
I had muted.
Okay.
But I'm here, yes.
All right. Listen, we'll... Because I got a couple questions to ask you in reference to the training and our challenges moving forward. But let me try to grab a couple of callers here. 727, area code, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yes, this is Diakiese Lungisani. I'm calling from St. Petersburg, Florida.
How are you?
I'm fine. Yourself?
Great.
That's good. I'm also the station manager for Black Power 96.3 FM, and I was calling in because I wanted to hear the chairman, you know, deepen how important it is for young Africans, you know, to see other Africans in positions of, you know, power and not, you know, referring to any sellouts or, you know, petty bourgeoisie Negroes, you know, who try to cater to the white ruling class, but, you know, genuine leaders in business, in areas of business, education, science, and even the arts and other positions that, you know, are prominently dominated by, you know, white people.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think that one of the reasons it was significant for us to have people like Glenn Ford and Charles Barron attending this school that we just did in St. Petersburg, Florida, the Candidates Training School. Here are examples of extraordinarily successful people, not rich people, but you've got somebody like Glenn Ford who has a history of establishing these communication entities, radio, the Black Agenda Report, for example. I heard a clip of Glenn Ford on this station that we are on right now. He's a successful person, and he has political integrity. And you know, and when we met Glenn Ford, it was his political integrity that attracted us to him, because we were the only organization I knew that was criticizing Barack Hussein Obama as white power in blackface. And Glenn debated, and he was fighting almost by himself around that question. I appreciated Glenn. And we had Charles Barron, who is an extraordinary, you talk about somebody who's functioning as a politician. It was important for Charles Barron to be here, because we know we had a lot of young people at this conference that we're talking about, the school that we just did, and to have Charles Barron and to show videos and things like that of what's happening in New York, in Brooklyn, where he was on city council until he termed out and then became a part of the state assembly. This is the kind of success that we want to show people, so that people can, you know, learn how that you can aspire for something. That's why, you know, we built several institutions in our party. You know, like we have a gym, a fitness center. We have created. We have a furniture store in Philadelphia and another furniture store in Oakland, California. And, you know, we have, you know, businesses that people, when they pass by this, they see this, they can experience it, and young black people can see these as examples of what we can accomplish ourselves as a people. And that's something that contributes to self-confidence in our community, to see that kind of thing, to experience it in the real world. And that's part of what's been under assault in our community for two generations or so right now. So I think it's extremely important. And I remember how Malcolm used to talk about how African people run from Africa, don't want to be associated with Africa until it looks like Africa is on the rise. And when Africa is on the rise and you can see victory on the horizon and things like that, then everybody wants to be an African. And I think the same, I think that's part of what we are confronted with. We as leaders have a responsibility to try to project the future that we want to take our people to. And that's why it's important to create these institutions. That's why it's important even to have the ability to be on this medium right now that we are talking about. This is an example to people of what it is, black people, what we can do, that we don't have to wait for CIA Cuomo on CNN. We don't have to work for lying Don Lemon or something like that on these other entities, that we can create our own entities. And guess what? As quiet as it's kept, as good as this show and this station is right now, there's some 10-year-old out there who is growing the capacity to do this medium 50 times, 100 times better than we can do, where we give him the example of what the possibilities are. That's why it's important that we have a radio station where young people can come, they can learn how to do radio, and they will be much better at it than we are today. So these examples are really important to our people, and that's what we have a responsibility to do when we profess to provide leadership, is that people need to be able, through us and our examples and what we do, to see the future that we're fighting for. Huey P. Newton used to say that the masses of our people learn through example and participation. I think that's true. And we have to provide the examples and give the people an opportunity to participate in securing our own freedom.
Brother, any other question?
Oh, no. Hey, that was it.
Listen, thank you for your call.
All righty, thank you.
Chairman O'Malley, you know, you talked, and the gentleman just raised a point about challenges in politics, and especially talking about black politicians that have been basically black faces on white power. And if you look at some of our young people that don't really understand, some politicians and integrationists or assimilationists hold people like Barack Obama, Cory Booker's, they hold them up for reverence, that this is some type of symbol to achieve in politics. But you're down in the Black Belt region. You're organizing down there. In fact, you're one of the people that's working with you will be a guest next week. That's Zaki Baruti out of the Ferguson area. He'll be with us next week. The challenges of organizing in the Black Belt, which could be an example to the country, because we can control those areas where our people are predominantly in population. But when you do that, you're running candidates that are in direct opposition to black faces of white power. Talk about some of the challenges, because we mentioned it earlier, but I just want you to reiterate this before you leave tonight. Because in your candidates forum, said that you're showing some of the young people that want to get involved how to raise money, how to frame a campaign message, teach them how to get the vote out, and how to use a referendum and ballot initiative process in addition to means of getting a national black agenda for self-determination issues on the ballot. Is that a challenge in your area or in the Black Belt trying to deal with this issue? Because we just see what happened in Ferguson, where some of our people voted back in the same Republican mayor that was there during the Michael Brown murder. So talk about some of the challenges. And although I know that we're going to defeat these challenges, but just talk about some of the challenges that you're dealing with.
Well, I think the problem, and it's not really peculiar to the South. You mentioned Cory Booker out of New Jersey, and there's a host of these forces who have been produced by white power to be representatives of our community. Mm-hmm. I call them like the Whoopi Goldbergs of the black political arena. You know, these are entertainers for white people, black entertainers for white people. And so there are a lot of them, you know, and they're all around the country. And that's one of the things that made this school important, and in my estimation, that helps to make the coalition important. And that's Zaki Baruti, for example. He has something that's going to be happening in May. I'll be there in St. Louis. And he's promoting that Africans run for political office throughout this country on the 19-point agenda.
Okay.
And what that does is and what we did with this school, and it was a powerful school. All of this will be available to people so that people can experience what we just did in the school all around the country and around the world, for that matter. But what we did and what we're in the process of doing is changing the entire political narrative and changing what should be expected of black politicians, so it becomes more difficult for people who, how the preacher is the only one who can interpret God's message and stuff like that. That's how the politicians are. And the people often don't have confidence to challenge them, and because they know everything. But what we do is arm people so that they can enter into this process themselves and help them destroy the mystery and the mythology surrounding the electoral process and say, this is what you got to do. And it's absolutely necessary for us to use this electoral process and deny this African petty bourgeois sellout class a monopoly on this instrument, so that, because it's not just that they mislead us, it's also that in the process of misleading us, they present a false picture and a false narrative to everybody in the world who think that black people, the whole of us, think just like these Negroes who are in office. So they need to have to fight for their lives against Africans who are going to be raising up the question of reparations, who are going to be raising up the question of freeing black political prisoners, who are going to be demanding an end to this whole mass incarceration of our people. They need to have to, and they won't speak to those questions because those are not issues on the Democratic platform. So we take them. We put our own platform together, and what we do is make it what might be difficult for us in Florida alone now becomes less difficult because they're talking about the same thing in Huntsville, Alabama. They're talking about the same thing in Houston, Texas. They're talking about the same thing in St. Louis, Missouri. They're talking about the same thing in Chicago. They're talking about the same thing in New York. They're talking about this. So this begins to happen all around the country. And then what was extremely difficult for us in Florida becomes less so because we're changing the entire narrative because of the participation by all these other forces around the country. That's the power of what it is that we just did. In some kind of isolated situation, we are weird and peculiar. But at the point where we get masses of people from everywhere to adopt this platform and to adopt this stance in political life, then we make it very difficult for these sellout Negroes to continue to sell us out without having to face some kind of consequences from our community. That's the power of it. That's the thing that makes me excited about what we just did on today and yesterday with this candidate school.
And you know, Chairman O'Malley, that makes me also proud that with the process, because I see it happening everywhere. And when I think of what happened in Gary that started that development of those, is that the element that history is here. We have the history to know that the coalition has to be independent to vet and impose its will on those candidates when they start to veer off the agenda. Which is what didn't happen, and that's what created
because
the
in 72,
political noise.
Mm-hmm. In 72, most of the leaders of that thing in Gary were tied to the Democratic Party. And because the Democratic Party was terrorized by the whole idea of black independent politics, they snatched those Negroes back. They had those Negroes backpedaling so fast that they were tearing up their shoes trying to retreat from the position that they took in Gary, Indiana. And there were thousands of people who went to Gary, Indiana with some expectations. And so that's part of what we said. Even if you look at the declaration that's associated with the 19-point declaration, you know, with the 19-point platform, we say that first loyalty has to be to this community, not to the Democratic Party, any other community, and that the any other institution. And that in fact, what we are saying is that people have to be loyal to this community. It has to be an independent politic that subscribes to the needs of this community, and here are the here's the platform that we are requiring. And Zaki already has got a couple of candidates running for office from the Green Party to adopt the 19-point platform. Okay. And, you know, we already have people running on the 19-point platform. And so in some places we're isolated doing this, but within the next few months and certainly before the year is over, we're going to see this happening all around the country. And Charles Barron been doing it by himself, you know, for years there. It's a new day that we have unleashed. And this school that we just did marks a new beginning in this struggle of our people, where we stop just talking about what's bad with us and begin to force public discussion around public policy, dealing with the contradictions impacting on black people in this country. That's something they haven't talked about for ages. And so we're going to force that. And we're going to make Negro politicians have to either say something about it or retire. And they have to run into young people and other people who adopt these politics and contest them in these black communities, because they've been able to have a free hand because nobody is really fighting them on these bold questions that demand resolution if black people are going to know any kind of relief at all, and certainly if we're going to have anything that looks like self-determination. So,
Brother O'Malley, listen, I want to thank you for being with us. I want to also thank Sister Kenji and Brother Cam Howard for kind of facilitating you being with us this evening. And the door is always open on Time for Awakening. If you want to come on, talk about some of these political developments, talk about politics, give us updates on the Black is Back Coalition, anything you need to do, you can always reach out to me. The door is open for you to come back on.
I want to thank you. And I would like to just announce that on May 27th, the African People's Socialist Party is sponsoring African Liberation Day in Washington, D.C. It's the 40th anniversary of the initial African Liberation Day that was mobilization that was held in Washington, D.C., the same date in 1972. Also, it's the 45th anniversary of the African People's Socialist Party. And so, you know, we're celebrating that, and we're hoping that people from throughout will come to Washington, D.C., to join us in this African Liberation Day mobilization. And people who are interested in this, and I hope there are a lot of people interested in it, will go to ALDUHURU.org and get all of the information, where it's going to be held, what time we're going to be in the different places, and join us in this African Liberation Day mobilization. I think it's going to be a magnificent mobilization, and I'm hoping that all of your listeners, wherever they're located, will be willing to come into Washington, D.C. Again, that's going to be happening on May 27th, and that's 47 days, 11 hours, 14 minutes, and 41 seconds from now. So,
Brother O'Malley, give out that email. I mean, not the email. The website address again.
It's ALD for African Liberation Day. Mm-hmm. ALDUHURU.org.
Good. Okay.
Thank you so much, my dear brother, and I really appreciate your listeners and the wonderful comrades who you had calling in and. You know, raising issues and correcting me in some instances. I really appreciate this discussion, and I thank you for being there and offering up this vehicle for us to discuss these critical questions that's important to our community and our people. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. Uhuru.
Peace, and we'll talk to you soon.
Uhuru, my brother. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
No, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
No, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you would on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
On the move. Assalamu alaikum. Free Mumia. Free Mumia. Free Mumia. Free Mumia now. Brothers and sisters, comrades, it's certainly my pleasure to be here. One of your state representatives from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I am ashamed to be a state representative in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania with a chump like Governor Ridge at the helm. I'm ashamed. But I wanted to come here today to let you know that some of us are not afraid, that even though we may be elected, we'll say what's on our mind. But we must understand that we're freedom fighters first, and that all the other things come next. That I'm a black man first, and then a state representative. I don't confuse the two. And I think it's time for us to wake up and realize and understand that you got a lot of us that are willing to go to battle, because the freedom ain't gonna never be free unless we take it. There's too many of us sitting around thinking that it's gonna come to us on some damn silver platter. Wake up, you fools, and understand this man has no respect for you. None. None whatsoever. And they will continue to do what they do to Mumia only because they feel that you don't have no heart. Well, let me just say this to y'all. I want to send a message to the FOP. I want to make it loud and clear so it won't be any mistake about what's being said today. And I'm saying it as a black man in the city of Philadelphia and not as the state representative. I ain't scared the hell of y'all. And I'm not going to let you intimidate our people either. That's over. So when you come on with some threat about you going to boycott every event that we have and you going to stop the people from coming to contribute their money, get the hell out of our way, because we ain't going nowhere. The time has come for everybody to wake up and realize that this ain't no joke. We're not going to let you take Mumia's life. And we want to send a message to America that the death penalty has got to end. We're going to wipe it out the same way they did in South Africa. But they did it by power of the people. When Nelson Mandela stepped out of jail and threw his hands up in the air, he was a strong brother. After 27 years being in jail, it didn't cripple his spirit. And I want to let all of you know that have come from all across this country. You got some brothers and sisters in Philadelphia that are willing to rumble no matter what and ain't afraid of the Philadelphia police, the national police, the FOP, and all the rest of them that come together with it. In my conclusion, I just want to say that I know the time has been rough today, but a lot of y'all need to know what this looks like for many of us here in the city of Philadelphia. Governor Ridge is getting a message again. Not only did those 115,000 calls go on, that's an underestimated of the number that have been calling, as an underestimated number of those who signed petitions, as an underestimated number of those who've come in and out of the city of Philadelphia from all across this country to give the kind of solidarity that's needed in order to make sure we free Mumia Abdul-Jabbar. We're not going to take this lying down. And I know that Mumia, in his heart, knows that we're all with him. So brothers and sisters, we're here as freedom fighters and black liberation strugglers who understand the importance of who and what we are, and we ain't gonna let no titles get in the way. Free Mumia. Free Mumia. Free Mumia. Free Mumia. No justice. No justice. Assalamu alaikum.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m. Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And again, I want to thank our special guest that joined us, activist, organizer, founder of the African Socialist International, ASI, African People's Socialist Party, APSP, and the leader of the Uhuru Movement, Chairman Omali Yeshitela, was with us in conversation this evening. Good discussion, Brother Richard.
Yes. You know, I wanted to also add what's going on, the formation of what's going on in Philadelphia or in Pennsylvania around the one in a million, around the same kind of issue, and that launching of for us in going out and actually going to touch bases with people in the community about registering as non-party affiliation as the first step. And hoping that at the national level, being a part of that kind of coalition, or so that, you know, these forces can be at least coordinated, because when you look at the agendas, they're the same, you know. So I just wanted to offer that, because I think it's important that that is taking place, that, as he mentioned, all over, you know. And we'll see next week, you said, Brother Barucci will be in to speak about what's going on in, is that St. Louis?
Yeah, the Ferguson, St. Louis, the Ferguson area, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, to kind of follow up on what you're saying, Brother Richard, you know, we see that there are grassroots conscious political movements going on now, and it seems, I mean, these men have been out here for a long time working in the vineyards, but it seems now that with the advent of Donald Trump and some of our people waking up, seeing that the past 8 years have been Barack Obama with a black face on white power, that some people now are taking another look to political organizing. So maybe the time is right now. Some people are waking at different times. Maybe the time is right now for our people to understand that we need to take a different approach to this politics thing as we plan to help our people move forward. It is a tool, and we can utilize it in a proper fashion. I mean, we've had people on from the Black Coffee Party, Brother Louis Ali, Dr. Millier, who was some of the founders of the party. We had Zaki Baruti on. We just had Chairman Omali Yeshitela. We've had Brother Klingman and Brother Amafika on from the 1 million conscious and conscientious black voters and contributors. I know that Brother Donnie Bradford, one of the organizers in the Tennessee area, went down to Ferguson to attend Brother Zaki Baruti's function at one time. So hopefully, and maybe this program can take some one little bit in helping, hopefully these entities can form a fist. The fingers ball up into one fist, because just like you said, Brother Richard, they are all working for the same goal. Mm-hmm. It would be more effective if we can all work together.
I had to throw out there, Elliot, because you see the formation within the Democratic Party, what might be the energizing, as Brother Omali has said, is the youth that are, you know, that you've seen the response into Mike Brown and other areas. That's the energy of a new generation, recognizing now that being independent and being involved in politics may not have a great contradiction as long as you're about self-determination. But what we see is the Democratic Party, they're creating their own pack because they feel that they're not getting the blacks within the Democrat, and that's the young blacks, because they don't feel that they're getting any respect out of the Democratic Party. So, you know, and I put that out there because nothing comes without struggle, and it's important for us to realize that as we create our form, you know, formalize, others are formalizing to maintain some space also.
You know,
I can't get it all twisted. We don't want to get it twisted.
I've seen some of the things you're talking about where some of the young black Democrats was disillusioned with the party and the way they've been treated. But as far as me right now, that's just talk. Because until they really show that that they want to change and not be black faces on white power, then because they realize what's going on. They're not stupid. They, just like we know about a lot of these movements going on, they know about it. They know, they hear some of the people, they hear some of the young rumblings of what's going on. They know that a lot of people, and especially young people, are not enthused about this system in general, and black politicians in particular. So, you know, it gives them an out right now, because they can use this guy Donald Trump as some type of torch bearer, flag waver, saying, you know, we're against it, we're against him. No, no, no. Whether it was Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, they need to be against this unjust system. That's what they need. You know, don't stand up and talk about I'm against Donald Trump, because some of these people now that had 8 years where they weren't saying nothing about what Obama was doing, all of a sudden their mouth is open in reference to Trump. But it's the same thing. I mean, he's throwing bombs in Syria, but Obama was throwing bombs in Libya. The same thing.
And destabilizing something that was going on that would have brought all the unification of the continent together, which may be shifting under the British control, under this Burdett, from what I'm seeing. So, yes, you know, and the distinction, as you say, not about being blackface on white power, that this mobilization is about, that slogan is about power, and particularly black power, and it has to be in the hands of black people, not in the hands of the Democratic Party or surrogates of the Democratic Party. That we are about self-determination, or in that broader context, sovereignty, which is also like an important core point to this whole formation as it goes forward. But it won't be no easy step, because imperialism is no joke.
Yeah, well, we'll see some of the like I said, you know, I've seen some of those reports that some of these the young black Democrats is a little disillusioned, but we'll see what's going on, because they had an opportunity. That bill that Cam Howard has been lobbying the CBC to get behind, the new H.R. 40 reparations bill, they got it. That's a perfect opportunity for them to come out strong in reference to that. I don't want no tacit type of just putting your name down and keeping silent. No, when these white folks was pushing things, you had the Tea Party, and now you got another fraction with them, that Freedom Party. So they're making their voices known. They ain't hiding nothing. Even when they make racist statements, they let you know exactly what they're doing. So, you know, it's time for our people to start making noise. Come out strong. If you for these things, you for the people, come out strong in reference to it. It's time
to
do it.
That's a good point about that H.R. 40, as a yardstick. To be able to hold them accountable. Are you really serious?
True. Yeah, it's a perfect opportunity. I mean, you know, you need, Brother Cam said you need 100 members to put this thing forth to the floor. We've seen where a majority of the the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus, voted for that resolution about Israel. So, but we see only 25 members got behind, at last count, got behind the new H.R. 40 bill. And I think out of them 25, six of them was white. So, you know, what's up with these other ones? We'll see, because we'll keep it in the forefront. We'll keep abreast of it. We'll bring Brother Cam Howard on for updates to talk about that and other things. You know, we're going to keep a lot of these things in the people's keep it in their minds, because heretofore a lot of these things wasn't discussed, so a lot of our people didn't know about what these guys are doing. So we're going to utilize this forum to pull the cover off, to let the people see exactly what's going on, because this is serious times. You know, our people don't need to be pawns in anybody's game. This guy's throwing bombs in Syria, and at any time something can break out. And then, you know, here comes, right now it's a volunteer service. Suppose that draft is instituted again. And then our people you got to put your name down. You know, you had thousands of whites during that Vietnam War said they wasn't fighting. They went to Canada and other places.
And I think. And here, from what they, were forcing those who didn't finish school or got locked up on any offense, it was either that or jail.
Yeah, well, that was a lot among a lot of the blacks.
Right.
Yeah, they were forced, kind of forced into it. But we'll see what happens because, you know, listen, during that time when Martin Luther King started changing his philosophy and he spoke out against that Vietnam War, and he was advised by several of his black colleagues, clergy colleagues, not to speak out against that war. But when he spoke out against it, he wasn't around a year afterwards. Because I think they were afraid that, you know, if he said anything in reference to blacks not enlisting or had diminished morale among blacks, that would have really hampered United States war efforts and dealt a serious blow to what they were doing. So you couldn't have black folks back then that had some type of influence on the minds of black people talking against that war. That's why he was advised by some of his black colleagues not to say anything about it. But he did. And that goes on a part of what Brother O'Malley was talking about leadership and courage, man. A lot of those men had courage. They knew if they said certain things, Richard, that they wasn't going to be around much longer. And that takes real courage because when you got a life, when you got a family, everybody wants long life to be around to see their grandchildren and great-grandchildren if possible. But, you know, when you're out there saying things and putting your life on the line, that takes courage, man.
Yes, it does.
That takes courage. And some people might not have it. You know, a lot of people have been critical of a lot of those things. You know, he said I lost my train of thought. In reference to it. But a lot of those things he was doing was a strategy to help our people. It wasn't anything that he was locked into because you could see that he wasn't locked into it. And I'm talking about King in particular when he started changing his philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And his own in his personal growth, as you say, in the personal growth of the people of the time, because you know the leadership is no good, is no stronger than the people that is leading, and when we start demanding more of ourselves, then we demand more of our leadership. And I think that the thing that was it's important in this is that dealing with the chairman and the coalition is doing, and with it, even with One in a Million and all the other organizations that are out there, we're moving from the mobilization part to the organization. And when we say that, we're moving from being just advocating for something, you know, to demanding, which means that we're actually organizing power. And it's and power is what this is all about. Self-power, self-sufficiency is about power. And power is in the power in the ability of your ability to organize. So when you're saying we're going towards the electoral process, we're not just, you know, coming out on the street and saying we want something. We're organizing, and he called that a school.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Teaching them how to market, teaching them how to craft a message. These are tools.
Exactly.
You know, and that means we're going for power and we're using a tool, because then we can be able to make the distinction. The hammer is not us. We're holding the hammer. We're not the Democratic. The Democratic Party is not us. We're using the party. We're using the political process. That's demonstration of power. And you can only do that through being organized. And even with King, one thing that they didn't give, you know, and I was listening to Kwame, King, they put him up to run for the head of the Baptist Convention. They didn't vote for him to be the head of, he would have been the head of an organization developing. Did you think those ministers want him to be the head of the organization? They didn't put him, they put somebody else in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, to giving him real power, not just being able to mobilize, but having an organized instrument as he developed his policy that was coming straight at the whole power structure about what black people demand and needed that check to be actually cashed.
Let me grab, you got time for one call there, Richard?
Yes, sir.
let me grab this one call here. Cause he was 215, area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Brother Elliot. How you doing, man?
Hey, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing. Hey, Brother Richard. How you doing?
How you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. You know, brother, it's ironic that Brother Richard, and by the way, I enjoyed your interview, Brother Yassatelli. I tuned in like the last maybe 15 minutes of your interview with Brother Yassatelli. It was a good interview, too, Elliot and Richard. I want to give y'all brothers y'all props. Good interview. Oh, man. Richard, you mentioned Dr. King just now, and you said that he was, you said they was considering voting for him to be head of the Baptist Convention, you were saying, Richard,
right.
If I heard you correctly.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's ironic you would bring up Dr. King because I listened to the terrestrial radio station here in Philadelphia, here in Philly, earlier today, and they was talking about Dr. King and the last year of his life when he became personal non grata, when he spoke at Riverside Baptist Church, when the name of his speech, of course, was Beyond Vietnam, where he denounced America as the number one purveyor of violence around the world. And this is something that black people don't want to come to grips with. And I've even said this to the host of this black station here in Philly about, I said, y'all do Dr. King a disservice every year. And I told a couple of the hosts that right over there, and anybody who listens to the station, they heard me mention it many times. I said, because if all y'all going to play is Dr. King's early speeches, I Have a Dream, about my kids next to white kids, the Jews and the Gentiles, all that stuff. I said, that you know and I know that the Dr. King in 1963 was a lot different from the Dr. King in 1967, 68. His whole views had totally changed. He was starting to sound more and more like Brother Malcolm than anybody, you know what I'm saying? And for you to keep playing that early, because Dr. King became awakened. You know, he wasn't just no dreamer. He saw reality and stuff. And when he spoke out against Vietnam, the backlash, and a lot of people don't realize, Brother Richard, and brother, what this man went through, and the host of the show today was speaking about that at length. What Dr. King went through the last year and a half of his life after that speech, his life was a living hell. He not only did he have gay Edgar Hoover going after him and stuff like that, he had many of the black community was turned against him. They said his friend rating the black community was at an all-time low. In the black community, we know how he was favored by the Caucasian community. That was a given. But in the black community, people that he marched for, got beat down for, they threw him under the bus. I mean, this man was personal non-grata. His SCLC went bankrupt. They people stopped funding them. They went bankrupt. The man was personal non-grata. He had been invited previously to many black churches around the country. They disinvited him.
Mm-hmm.
Many, you know, many listeners, I mean, we our people need to understand what this man went through.
In fact,
man,
in Memphis, if I'm not mistaken, the leadership there didn't want him to come. The people wanted him to come there.
That's
to speak
right.
For the
that's
the right. Trash man. But the black leadership there didn't want him necessarily to come there.
And the same thing here in Philadelphia, some of these black preachers that's up in there